The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, I talked about generosity, the first of the 10 paramis, or the 10 perfections. Last week, I had a little introduction about the perfections, the paramis, so I won't repeat that today. But today, I'd like to talk about the second of the 10 paramis, which is called sila, or ethical conduct. And they're both part of this list of the 10 paramis, but they're also both part of the three pillars of practice, together with bhavana, which means meditation or cultivation, and it's often referred to as meditation. So being part of those lists shows the importance of sila in the Buddha's teachings. And there's also another list of three basics of practice, which is the practice of sila, samadhi, and panya, ethical behavior, concentration, and wisdom. So sila is also showing up in this list. So there's some importance in this subject, some foundational aspect to our practice. And just like with the topic of generosity, or dana, and the Buddha also often started teaching his disciples about sila before he would give instructions in meditation. So sila and dana, the ethics and the generosity, were seen as the foundation for our practice. So today I'd like to dive a little deeper into this subject. And sometimes it's called ethics or ethical behavior or moral discipline. So that are some translations of sila. Well, earlier on in my practice, I thought, oh, this is quite a boring topic. But once I started to understand on a deeper level this topic of sila, and I started to engage with it more and more in my practice and in my life, I really started to appreciate it and see the foundational aspect of it for this Buddhist path. And could see that it is a foundation for the path to less and less suffering and more happiness. And the basics of sila, the basic teaching on sila, is the teaching on the five precepts. So today I would like to dive deeper into those five precepts. And sometimes they're called training rules. Since they are meant not to be strict rules, they are more like trainings that we can undertake. I will briefly name them first before I continue. The first one is the training rule of abstaining from taking life. Second is the training rule of abstaining from taking what is not given. The third is the training rule of abstaining from sexual misconduct. The fourth is the training rule of abstaining from false speech. And the fifth is the training rule of abstaining from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis of heedlessness. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is a renowned monk and scholar, he says that these five training rules are the minimal ethical code for lay followers of the Buddha. And monastics have like 227 rules, the males and the females 300 something. So as lay people, we have five, so that's pretty good. It's a little easier. These five training rules are the core of the teachings on ethics. And when we adhere to these training rules, or intend to adhere to them, then we will have this basic level of wholesomeness and non-harming in our lives. And we greatly reduce any harm that we inflict upon others and ourselves. So it will help us to stay on a wholesome path if we have the intention to have these training rules in our lives. Because what can happen when we have the intention to adhere to these principles, then each time that we might have the inclination to deviate from it, then we can get like an inner signal like, oh, wait, that's not what I was intending to do. And we might be able to stop ourselves in our tracks. Like if we would not have this intention to adhere to these training rules of non-harming, then we might step into the over the line into this harmfulness, since then that inner signal might not help us out. And for example, if we don't have an intention to abstain from taking life, then we might not think much of killing a mosquito, you know, that has kept us up all night with this buzzing sound, and we might just smash it against the wall. Or if we don't think about abstaining from false speech, then we might not think much of just telling this lie to our boss about being sick so we don't have to go to work. So when we do have these intentions, like the intention to abstain from taking life or abstain from false speech, then before we start smashing that mosquito, we might be thinking, oh, wait, I had this intention not to kill any living being. So let's just get a glass and a piece of paper and catch the mosquito. Or we might catch ourselves like, oh, wait, I'm about to tell a lie to my boss. So maybe I can do this a different way. So we might be able to change course into a more wholesome way of being. So, but why would we even want this wholesome life, a life based on non-harming, which basically means a life based on compassion and kindness? And I don't think I have to sell this actually to you all, but just in case, one way of investigating this question is to reflect on, like, how does it feel to act from wholesomeness? What does that effect, what's the effect in our body and mind when we are wholesome, when we are doing wholesome things, like just letting the mosquito out with a glass and a piece of paper, for example? And how does it feel to harm ourselves or others? What does it feel like in body and mind when we do smash that mosquito against the wall? So we can reflect on this in our lives with many different examples. This is just one small example, of course. And what we might find is that when we do harm ourselves or others, that it actually feels painful and unpleasant. And when we manage to act from this non-harming place, from a place of compassion and kindness or other forms of wholesomeness, that it feels good, that it really feels like a good thing to do. We feel wholesome. And these states of minds and actions that coming from those wholesomeness result in more ease and freedom and peace in our hearts and minds. There's this warmth. And when we do act wholesome, then we also often get this reflected back. Not always, of course, but often when we are kind towards others, then others tend to be kind towards us. And when we are honest and truthful, others tend to trust us more. And when we are committed to non-harming in general, then others tend to feel safe with us. So we can reflect really back into our lives and into our environment, and the people and also beings, like animals, can also really respond to that. They can reflect that back at us. And there's like a wonderful sutta where the Buddha talks about this, about how we as lay people can hold these precepts. And it's called, the sutta is called the People of Bamboo Gate in the Samyutta Nikaya. And I wanted to share some pieces of this sutta with you. It goes into the first of the first four of those five precepts. And then I'll share the piece on each of those precepts from the sutta and talk a bit more in depth on each precept. And then I will fill it in with the fifth precept and also see if I can explain a little bit why the fifth precept might not be in this sutta. And in the sutta, the Buddha was visited a village which is called the Bamboo Gate. And a large group of lay followers came to the Buddha to hear his teachings when he was visiting this village. And lay followers were householders. They were talking to the Buddha, and they said to the Buddha, Master Gotama, and Gotama was the Buddha's clan's name. They said, Master Gotama, we have such wishes, desires, and hopes as these. May we dwell in a home crowded with children. May we enjoy acacia and sandalwood. May we wear garlands, scents, and unguents. May we receive gold and silver. With the breakup of the body after death, may we be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world. As we have such wishes, desires, and hopes, let Master Gotama teach us the Dharma in such a way that we might have all those things. And the Buddha responded that he would teach them, and he said, what householders is the Dhamma exposition applicable to oneself? Here, householders, a noble disciple reflects thus. I am one who wishes to live, who does not wish to die. I desire happiness and am averse to suffering. Since I am one who wishes to live, who does not wish to die, I desire happiness and am averse to suffering. If someone were to take my life, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Now, if I were to take the life of another, of one who wishes to live, who does not wish to die, who desire happiness and is averse to suffering, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to the other. What is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? Having reflected thus, he himself abstains from the destruction of life, exhorts others to abstain from the destruction of life, and speaks in praise of the abstinence from the destruction of life. Thus this bodily conduct of his is purified in three respects. End quote. So the Buddha, he points to that doing unto others what we do not want to have done unto ourselves would be disagreeable and displeasing for both parties. So how can we do unto another what we do not want to have done unto ourselves? And the first training rule or precept is about taking life. And often we might think about taking another person's life, but the Buddha meant the lives of any living being, so also animals, from the smallest insects to the biggest animals. So just like us, every living being has the wish to live, the wish to thrive, to be happy. Every human being, and also every annoying mosquito or pesky ant on our kitchen counter, they all are trying to live their lives as best they can with their particular condition, traits, and characteristics. And like it is the characteristic of the mosquito to need to sting other beings in order to survive. It really can't help it. It's just doing whatever it needs to do to survive and thrive. So abstaining from taking any life is very wholesome. Just the mere fact of the abstaining from it, like if we have this inclination to kill the mosquito or the ants on our counter or whatever it is, and we don't do it, that's very wholesome. We stop ourselves in our tracks. And the Buddha points even out that we could also exhort others to abstain from taking life. And we could speak in praise of abstaining from taking life. And this way we are even contributing to possibly avoiding others to do the same, to take those lives of others or of other beings. So if we talk about this, or our example maybe might inspire others to not take lives either. And I once told my mother about the five precepts in Buddhism, and she's not a Buddhist at all. But a few years later, I learned that ever since I had talked about the precepts, she had actually been escorting little insects outside that had crept into her house, and instead of killing them like she used to do, which was quite a surprise to me, that just this mere fact of talking about it had such a profound effect on her. That's very sweet. And then the second precept in the sutta, he says the following, and they all go a little bit the same, they have the same format. So for the second one, it's householders, a noble disciple reflects thus. If someone were to take from me what I have not given, that is to commit theft, it would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Now, if I were to take from another what he has not given, that is to commit theft, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Sorry, to the other, either. What is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? Having reflected thus, he himself abstains from taking what is not given, exhorts others to abstain from taking what is not given, and speaks in praise of abstinence from taking what is not given. Thus, his bodily conduct of his is purified in three respects. End quote. So here too, we reflect, like, if we don't want it to have done to us, then why would we do it to another? And often there's a little bit of confusion, like, what does taking what is not given actually constitutes? And there are a lot of situations that it is very clear, like shoplifting, we know all that. It's not, that is like taking what is not given. Or when we are teenagers and we might grab some money out of our parents' wallets, that's not taking what's not given. But what if we want to bring this beautiful fall leaf into our house that we find outside, or get a flower from the side of the road, or we find something in a public space that seems to have been left behind? Are we taking what is not given? And the Buddha defines taking what is not given in the following way in another sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya. He says, abandoning the taking of what is not given, one does not take the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest in ways that can be construed as theft. End quote. So from this we can infer that taking what is not given is about what is being construed as theft. And I think it might be different in different cultures. So we probably all have a good sense in the culture that we, our main culture that we live in, like what is being construed as theft in our culture. And in the situations that are not construed, can be construed as theft, we can take things. Like in the natural world, it's usually not appropriated to something or someone. So we can take that leaf or that flower on the side of the road, as long as we don't pick it from someone's yard. So we can kind of use our common sense to discern what would be considered taking what is not given. We can use our own inner moral compass. So for the third precept, the Buddha says in that sutta, householders, a noble disciple reflects thus. If someone were to commit adultery with my wives, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Now, if I were to commit adultery with the wives of another, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to the other either. What is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. So how can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? Having reflected thus, he himself abstains from sexual misconduct, exhorts others to abstain from sexual misconduct, and speaks in praise of abstinence from sexual misconduct. Thus, this bodily conduct of his is purified in three respects. End quote. So here we see that the society at the time of the Buddha was kind of male-oriented, patriarchic. Since the Buddha is talking about this adultery with my wives. But what is actually listed in the five training rules, if you translate it, is abstaining from sexual misconduct. And I find it helpful to translate this or to look at this in our modern times. Like, what does it mean in our society today? And that will be different, that answer will be different for different people, for different cultures, for different subcultures. So we can look for ourselves, what does this mean to me or the subculture I'm living in? What would I not want to have done upon myself? to a certain extent, because some things we might like, might others might not like. So we need to think about that too. But for example, we might be in an open relationship and mutually agreed upon that it is open. So the classic definition of adultery might not fit us. Or even like we might be not married, but in a committed monogamous relationship. But at the time of the Buddha, these examples might have been considered sexual misconduct because we weren't married or we were having multiple partners or whatnot. Like on the other hand, in our society, what the Buddha is describing in this sutta, multiple wives, might be considered sexual misconduct by certain people in our society. So what was okay at the time of the Buddha might not be okay now and vice versa. So it's a very interesting exploration. But always the bottom line with these precepts is, with all of them, is that are we harming ourselves or others or not? And that is more important than the cultural interpretation of these precepts. Like if we find that we are harming others or even ourselves with our sexual energy, then we are not adhering to this precept. So an obvious example would be if you use your sexual energy to force someone to do something, for example, rape. Or if you commit adultery when you are in a monogamous relationship, a mutually agreed upon monogamous relationship. So if we look at it like this, then adhering to this precept can prevent a lot of suffering. For example, if we are in this monogamous relationship and we get tempted to commit adultery, then we could have this inner signal like, oh wait, we promised to not have any sexual misconduct, to abstain from that. So then we might be able to stop ourselves in our tracks and prevent a lot of suffering for our partner and this third party involved and ourselves, just to name a simple example. And then the fourth precept is abstaining from false speech. And in the sutta that I've been referring to, the Buddha actually talks about four types of false speech. One of them is false speech. The other one is divisive speech, and then harsh speech and idle chatter. So I'll read the passage that is about false speech, and we'll just kind of briefly go over the other types of speech. So the passage about false speech goes like this. Householders, a noble disciple reflects thus. If someone were to damage my welfare with false speech, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Now, if I were to damage the welfare of another with false speech, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to the other either. What is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? Having reflected thus, he himself abstains from false speech, exhorts others to abstain from false speech, and speaks in praise of abstinence from false speech. Thus, this verbal conduct of his is purified in three respects. End quote. So false speech is about not lying, not telling untruths, not being deceitful, but being truthful. It's not so much about speaking of falsehood per se. It is about speaking of falsehood that we know is false and we portray as being the truth. Because sometimes we might not even know that we are saying something that is not true. And like someone tells us something and we think it's true, we kind of assume it's true and we tell it to other people. And then later we find out it wasn't true at all. So in that case, we have not broken this precept because we just didn't know. Eh? So it's about our intention behind our words. Are we intending to speak the truth? Or are we intending to tell a deliberate lie? And when we speak untruths, then we usually are motivated by either greed or aversion. And we often want something that we don't have right now. And for example, a child might lie that it has not had a cookie yet in order to get a second cookie. Well, already got a cookie. So that would be a lie motivated by greed. Or we might lie to avoid something that we don't want. And we might not want to participate in this Zoom meeting at work. And we say we have some other important thing to do while we don't. And that would be an example of a lie motivated by aversion. And when we start to be aware of the motivation of our lies, then we might be able to work with the greed and the aversion directly. We might investigate it, feel the unwholesomeness of it, etc. Instead of lying in order to, quote unquote, resolve this feeling of greed or aversion. And for example, with a meeting, we might look at our aversion to attend the meeting, investigate it, like what's behind it? What does it feel like in body and mind? Discover different layers of it. Maybe we find out like, oh, it's actually, we're resentful towards this one colleague that's attending this meeting and we don't want to face that. So then we might be able to see, you know, more clearly what's going on, and we might be able to work with it. We could, for example, talk to our colleague, or we might be able to just face what's happening and be able to attend the meeting after all, or whatever is needed to work with the aversion. And so the other three aspects around speech that the Buddha names in the suttas, in this sutta is this divisive speech, the harsh speech, and the idle chatter. And the Buddha says, if someone were to divide me from my friends by divisive speech, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. And then the whole other thing, rest of the quote comes. The Buddha advises us to not divide people through our speech. Instead, we can use our speech to bring harmony to our relationships with others, as well as bring harmony between other people. That's the beautiful aspect of this part of speech, that we can utilize it for the good. And about harsh speech, the Buddha says, if someone were to address me with harsh speech, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. And then the idle chatter, he says, frivolous speech and idle chatter. If someone were to address me with frivolous speech and idle chatter, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. And then he continues to say that when we reflect on it, we will refrain from doing this unto another. Like with the other quotes. I won't go into any deeper into these types of speech, which is wonderful to talk about as well, but I don't have time for that today. And so the fifth precept is not covered in the sutta. And the fifth training rule is to abstain from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis of heedlessness. And I'm using Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation here. And what he's basically referring to is not to take any alcohol. And often this precept gets like translated in a little bit different way, like not to take any substance that may cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. But the literal translation of the precept actually only talks about alcohol. And I could see that including all substances that cloud the mind can be really useful. And like illegal drugs can be very harmful to our bodies and minds and can really lead to heedlessness. So I can see that it's useful to include that in this precept as well, but I just wanted to give the literal translation. And I think that the reason that this precept is not covered in the sutta that we're discussing today, that might be that it's the only precept that's not directly about our relationship to others. It's more about our own body and mind. But of course, we could argue that if we take intoxicants, alcohol or drugs, and that we can be more of a nuisance to other beings, and we might, you know, sooner lose control over ourselves and harm others or ourselves. And we might not have done that if we would have stayed sober, for example. And the caveat here is that this precept is absolutely not about prescription drugs. They can sometimes cloud our mind, but we should always take the drugs that our doctors have prescribed to us. So it's not a violation of this precept at all. And it's really important to stress this, because there have been times that people have misinterpreted this and not taken their prescription drugs anymore. So please keep on taking your drugs as your doctor has prescribed them. One thing that people are sometimes also confused about is, like, are we allowed to have a glass of wine or beer as long as we don't get intoxicated? And Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, and it's a quote, he says, "The precept, it must be stressed, does not prohibit merely intoxication, but the very use of intoxicating substances. Though occasional indulgence may not be immediately harmful in isolation, the seductive and addictive properties of intoxicants are well known. The strongest safeguard against the lure is to avoid them altogether." End quote. So strictly adhering to this precept would mean not taking any intoxicants other than our prescription drugs, and sometimes like some alcohol in cooking or in medicines is allowed. That's not part of the precept. But like many people, including many Dharma teachers, hold this precept more light, like having a glass of beer or wine every once in a while taking care that one doesn't get intoxicated and heedless, they see that as fine and okay. So it's really up to each individual. I just wanted to offer the strict Sutta interpretation, basically, as well as the looser Western interpretation. And it's a choice that we can all make for ourselves. So these are the five precepts, or the five training rules. The training rule of abstaining from taking life. The training rule of abstaining from what is not given. Training rule of abstaining from sexual misconduct. And the training rule of abstaining from false speech. And then the last one, the training rule of abstaining from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis of heedlessness. And it's up to us to see if we want to take these up, these training rules, in our lives. And the Buddha offered them for lay people as a foundation for practice. And in that way, as if it's a kind of a foundation for our release from suffering. So the foundation for awakening. And the Buddha was also clear that most of us will, every once in a while, break one or more of these training rules. If we do choose to, you know, take them on, to adhere to them, or have the intention to adhere to them, then it happens that we every once in a while might break them. And the Buddha really recognized that. He knew that we're not saints. So the Buddha simply encourages us to learn from it if we break our precept. And we can just refresh our intention by taking on the training rules. And the way that we take them on is, or at least one way of doing it, is to sit in front of a Buddha image, or kneel if you feel a lot of devotion, for example. It's not required at all. But then we can recite the training rules if we are sitting or standing or kneeling in front of a Buddha image. Like, for example, I undertake the training rule of abstaining from taking life. I undertake the training rule of abstaining from, etc. And that way we can take those five precepts, the five training rules. Yeah, and I ran over a little bit, so we could open it up to questions. And comments and sharings. Feel free if you have anything that you'd like to share or ask. Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much for this teaching. That was really rich. I didn't sleep a lot last night because my cat brought mouse in the house. I tried to figure out how to take it outside without harming it. So I spent the half of the night, you know, up, and I succeeded in bringing it outside and leave it in the garden. But I was happy that I, you know, practiced this precept of non-harming. But I know that I'm lacking equanimity because I felt so much pain and compassion for the mouse, you know. So I know that this is my problem, to balance equanimity and the compassion we can, and the joy also to succeed in following a precept. Also at work, I know several years ago, I felt often bad when my boss came, because even though I didn't do anything wrong, I didn't follow the precept. I wasn't studying Buddhism at that time, but I always had this feeling that I was doing something wrong and feeling bad. And now that I'm following this precept, when my boss is coming, I feel happy and, you know, relieved and free. And that's always, I like noticing that it helps me keeping up. So,
yeah, that's great. Thank you for sharing, Holly. And it's nice to notice how the precepts can make us feel like, yeah, we're doing the right thing. Yeah. And with the mouse, I was thinking, like, you said that you felt compassion, which is also a natural response of our heart, to feel compassion for the pain that the mouse is feeling. So, like with the Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, like each of them kind of arises in the appropriate situation. So compassion arises when we meet suffering. So it's a very appropriate response to have suffering. And equanimity is there when, you know, when the situation is a bit more neutral and there's not so much else going on. So it's actually, I think, yeah, a real natural thing for compassion to arise when you see the most suffering. Anything else today? Oh, to me, yeah.
I think I read years ago about the fifth precept, and it makes it easier to feel, how would I say that, to feel committed again to practice the other precepts, because this is one of the reasons not to take intoxicants is because that would prevent a person not be able to observe the other four precepts because of heedlessness. And yeah, when I read that, it makes more sense to me. You know, why we should abstain from alcohol, because I think if we are really committed to the practice, not to be heedless, so even a little bit of alcohol would make it harder. Because in the instance that, in the moment that we take something, even just something very light, I found that even if I take something very light, like a cocktail, you know, just to just to please, you know, when people invite me and they say, oh, you have to try this, try it. And even if I take a sip, I feel that in the moment that I take that, I lost the commitment to keep the precepts. So, yeah, what really helped me is to remember that, you know, not to take anything that would make the mind heedless and not able to observe the other four precepts. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that with me. And that's, yeah, I can see that. It is much harder to observe the other four precepts when we are intoxicated with alcohol, even if it's just a little bit. It does something to the brain. I think I heard a scientist say, like, even a little bit of alcohol will already have quite a profound impact on our brains, even though we might not consciously really notice it as much. For some people, at least, they don't really notice it as much. But still, there is something happening that makes us less responsible, to say, looser. So it can be a problem. But I think, I just wanted to offer that, you know, some teachers do say, like, it's okay to drink one or two glasses of wine as long as you don't feel intoxicated, and that so that everyone can make a decision for themselves. Some people really, for them, it's really useful to really adhere to the precept and not take anything because of the reason you're saying, Twee, and also because it's just, you know, once you take a little bit, then it's really hard to not take a lot. So it's better to abstain at all, abstain fully. For some people, it's easier to do it like that. So, yeah, yeah. But yeah, the Buddha was really clear about it. No alcohol at all. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Hello. Oh, yeah. So there was one raised hand. You're calling yourself low today.
There's one other feeling I have about intoxicants, which is it clouds awareness.
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah.
And extended sobriety has opened for me a deepened appreciation of the wonder of life as it is. So it's not only the moment-by-moment awareness, but just the awareness of the grand miracle of creation.
That's a wonderful, beautiful reflection. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Lo.
Hi there. Thank you so much. This was really very, very enlightening for me. And today, when I go to talk with my apartment manager to tell her that I need to leave because there is a, you know, socially unacceptable behavior from my neighbor downstairs, which is sort of threatening. And with these precepts in the forefront of my mind, as I apply them to this guy, he certainly is violating a couple of them. And when I go in there to talk with her, I can use the precepts in my presentation to her that, you know, I don't need to squash any mosquitoes here. I just need to, you know, say what's true. So thank you. This was really great. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing.